blast from the past. Good to hear the theme song again. Welcome back to those of you who listened to the series all those years ago, and welcome to anyone listening for the first time. This is the Dead Man Talking podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Hannaford.
Certainly is a blast from the past, Alex. This is producer Pete, and we are back with a special update episode of the podcast. And it's been, what, 7-8 years since the season finale? Why has it been such a long gap? I mean, Alex, I know why it's been such a long gap, but why don't you tell the listeners why?
Yeah, the Dead Man Talking podcast ended in 2019, so it's been a long time. But we've got something really important, I think, to share with not just the people that listened to it the first time round, but anyone who is listening to it for the first time. They called him the Railroad Killer.
The Railroad Serial Killer.
Railway serial killer.
And for more than a decade, he crisscrossed the US by freight. Just very briefly, the Dead Man Talking podcast was all based around confessions that one of America's most notorious serial killers, a guy called Angel Resendez, made to me on Texas death row back in 2003.
One that I did, that the lady, the blame for me doing it, she's serving life in prison.
Who?
This is the Diamantina Salinas Colojaco.
Okay, can you spell?
And so for those that haven't listened to it, what me and you did, Pete, was spend basically a year of our lives investigating these disembodied confessions. Disembodied because he was executed back in 2006 by the state of Texas.
So she's in prison for murder?
For murdering her husband when I did it.
And the reason we're doing an update is because one of those confessions was to a murder in 1998 in Houston. And it was, the victim was a man called Daryl Colojaco, and two people are still in prison for that murder. But I think, as we're going to kind of talk about, it's not so clear cut, is it, Pete?
It certainly isn't. And I think it's important to say that just because we've had this 7-8 year gap, you have still very much been involved in the case. You know, for me, as producers, often you move from one project to the next, but as journalists like yourself, you're kind of all in. And I've been out to visit you a few times in the States since we wrapped on Dead Man Talking, and you've always got sort of updates for me. Generally, they're about the frustration, how slow things are moving on, and sort of the wheels of justice in Texas. But we feel like enough has happened recently that it's important that we get another episode out so people understand what's happening.
7 years is an incredibly long time for me when I'm sort of hopping on Zoom calls to find out what the latest developments are. But imagine what that's like for the people in prison waiting for justice. And all I've been thinking about all this time is, when is something going to happen? When is something going to happen? And I think that what our listeners will find out is that things are starting to happen. At the heart of this podcast was this one confession out of many that he made to me. This one confession to this murder in Houston. And going into a little bit more detail, it was this guy called Daryl Colojaco who'd been bludgeoned to death in his home, in the living room of his home. And very shortly afterwards, I think the next day, his wife was picked up for the murder. And her boyfriend, a guy called Andres Mascaro, her name was Diamantina Colojaco. Our podcast kind of spanned a lot of different confessions, but this one, there seemed to be the most jeopardy because these guys were still in prison. And we believed strongly at the end of our podcast series that there had been a wrongful conviction in this case. And 7 years ago, at the finale, I said, I'm not going to let this go. But as listeners will find out, it wasn't me that was taking the baton then and kind of running with it in terms of investigating this story.
Well, before we have a listen to some of the other people that took the baton from you, do you want to give us a very quick recap of where the series ended? I will say, actually, before you give this recap, if anyone wants to go back and listen to the final episode, it has some very useful summaries. So go back and have a listen and then rejoin us here. Or if you don't want to do that, Al's about to give us a very quick update.
So basically, yeah, from his death row cell, Resendiz confessed to the murder of Daryl Colajacco in Houston, and he described details inside the house, paintings, the color of the carpet, unusual detail on the wooden fence outside that were never publicly reported. And his own appellate lawyer confirmed that he had privately confessed the murder to him as well. And what was interesting, and I think this is the real kind of core of our podcast, was that we showed that there was precedent, all right? Don't forget, he's on death row. He's going to die for this murder. He had no reason to do this, yet he led detectives to a missing victim's body in Florida, which I think proved that even his vague confessions could be accurate. Another murder he confessed to in Georgia was eerily similar to the Colajacco case. So two people had been arrested for that too. They were in jail for a year. The death penalty was on the table initially for them. And then Resendiz's confession ended up freeing them. The Colajacco murder scene suggested an experienced killer, not a potentially first-time offender like Andres. We found out that there was racism in Andres's trial. Andres said his confession was false. He claimed police threatened that his family would be deported if he didn't sign this confession. There was no lawyer present when he confessed. And there was no physical evidence linking him to the murder. You'll recall, Pete, the state of Texas said that Diamantina essentially orchestrated the murder of her husband for the insurance money, and that Andres actually physically carried out the murder. Law students that I mentioned reviewed the case. They said essentially it was a circumstantial case built almost entirely around these confessions. And crucially, which I thought was kind of the real wow moment in our podcast, a previously unnoticed court record, the law school found in the record that federal agents had been showing neighbors, Colajacco's neighbors, a photograph of another suspect, somebody that was not Andres, at the time of the murder, suggesting that they may have been looking for a suspect connected to multiple murders or crimes across state lines, which is the only reason federal law enforcement would get involved.
And as the final episodes were launched, other people started catching wind of it, didn't they? And the story started gaining traction away from what we were doing.
Yeah, that's right. So in our final episode, I actually met John Hardin, who was the, you know, running Proclaim Justice, which was this Texas nonprofit dedicated to overturning wrongful convictions. And he was concerned enough to take the case on. And this is kind of the point about we were making at the beginning. Why did the series end when it did? We had done everything we could. I'm not a lawyer, but we had basically presented our case. And here was Proclaim Justice saying, we'll take it from here. So coming up, we'll be hearing from a few people who have been working on the case since we left it. And I think they've got some pretty explosive things to say.
Before we move on to that, what about Andres in all this? I mean, you've already given the spoiler at the top that he's still in prison. How long has it been now?
So yeah, Andres went to prison in 1998 when he was convicted. And we've been in touch with him, not only when we started the podcast, Pete, back in 2018, but ever since then, I've been writing to him and keeping him abreast of what's been happening.
While you have been in touch with him over the past few years, how has he seemed?
We met him when we made the podcast, you know, in person. My communication's always been by letter, and he's communicating in Spanish. So I'm sort of using Google Translate to translate it and then writing him a letter back, which I translate into Spanish and send him. As much as you can tell how people feel from that, he seems positive and upbeat. You know, I'll read you some of the most recent letter. This was literally about 2 weeks ago. So he said, things in my life are going well, all things considered. I've been assigned to the McConnell unit in Beeville, which is in Texas, for 27 years now. Most of the guards and inmates know me, as my job as a janitor keeps me out in the open where they can see me. The advantage of this job is that it keeps me busy and helps me stay out of trouble. It's physical work, which helps me maintain my health. He says, since I first heard from you, I put everything in your hands. That gives me both confidence and joy. Even during the COVID pandemic, you all continue to stay in touch with me, which demonstrates your dedication and commitment to my cause. I've always been fully aware of my innocence. However, that isn't something one goes around telling people all the time. Sometimes things just don't turn out the way you want them to. The hardest part was maintaining my faith when my mother passed away. That's a devastating blow for anyone, but it's even harder when you have to face it while separated from your family and unable to even attend the funeral. Knowing that there are people who love me and who believe in my innocence strengthens me even further. I'm grateful to everyone who is fighting on my behalf.
It's just heartbreaking, isn't it? The fact that he's been in for such a long time and he wasn't able to go to his mother's funeral. I can't imagine what that was like.
It's heartbreaking, but honestly, the emotion I've felt since we ended the podcast has been one of frustration. You know, for me, it's just incredible. And I think this podcast episode will kind of reveal something about what's been sort of happening and what's happened and why it's so frustrating. We have something really explosive to tell people. But even then, as you pointed out, Andres is still in prison. And I don't think the people listening to this will quite fathom how that's possible.
Who are we going to hear from first?
Well, listeners to the first series probably won't remember the name Danny Waxler because he was very much behind the scenes. He worked with John Hardin at Proclaim Justice as a private investigator. This was the organization that stepped forward at the end of the series. Danny's based in Texas and he has years of experience as a private investigator. And he started digging into the case for PJ right in the beginning. So this is when we finished in 2019. And I caught up with him to share what they had uncovered. Honestly, Pete, I've never met anyone. I know Danny very well now. I've never met anyone so dogged and determined as Danny. So I've spent pretty much the last 6 years speaking to Danny on weekly Zoom calls, you know, phone calls, text messages, in person, and he's become a friend. And Danny's had an extraordinarily difficult time on this, not least because of the delays caused by COVID and the bureaucracy in the Texas legal system, something he's had to deal with again and again in other cases as well.
Great stuff. Okay, let's have a listen to your interview with Danny Waxler.
So basically, the last episode of Dead Man Talking, I met John Hardin, who worked for Proclaim Justice with you, and he was very troubled by what we had found and what we'd uncovered in the podcast, and Proclaim Justice then took the case on. And then you were obviously a massive part of that, and you began your investigation. So I wondered if we could sort of go back to, I'm guessing, 2019, 2020. So where did you begin?
We listened to your podcast and met with you and felt like, you know, we need to get every document we can. We need to start as though this is a brand new investigation. And that's what we did. So I dug in, and digging in meant going through everything that we had, what you were able to supply us with, and what we could obtain on our own through our requests through different agencies. So we take a translator and an attorney, and we go visit Andres in the prison. And he was somewhat perplexed and happy at the same time that we were there for him, you know. And a lot of it was him retelling us what we had already knew and you had kind of uncovered in the podcast.
There was also a massive effort that you guys put in to getting the case files from the DA's office. This is the Harris County DA's office. And when you finally got these, and this was something that we weren't able to do for the podcast, there was something that I think you described at the time as critically important. And this was a copy of a bloody palm print from the crime scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell us about that and why was that significant?
We had pictures that gave us prints that we had never seen, and we thought it was just fingerprints. So we were able to just send them off to a fingerprint analyst in California and just says, look, we're just taking a shot here. Do you have any idea what these are? And he looked at the prints and says, this looks like a left palm print that was left in the blood before it had dried at the scene of the crime. And then we knew we had something.
So you found, just to be clear, not only were these palm prints, this bloody palm print in the case file, but you then subsequently found out that at the time of the investigation, they had actually run this through a search against, specifically, tried to match it against the victim, Daryl Colahacco. Mm-hmm. And the two people who they had arrested for the murder, the person that they thought arranged it or organized it, Diamantina, and Andres Mascaro, the person they thought had carried it out. And what you discovered was that this palm print matched none of those three people, correct?
Correct.
But they knew this at the time, back in 1998.
Yes. Now, not to defend the investigation, but I will say they only ran it through at the time in 1998. They only had their own database. So it would have been run only through prints known to Harris County. And the irony is, it was Angel Resendez and the case of the famous railway killer that led to the FBI forming a coalition with all county, state governments to create a repository of sharing fingerprints across the country. Because in 1998, we were not digitally where we are today.
So basically, we can say that they had categorically excluded Andres Diamantina and the victim, because that's the only prints that they had in their database when the murder happened. And what you're saying is that they weren't then able to run the palm print against a national database, which is fair enough, but that sort of is a separate thought. The fact is, and correct me if I'm wrong, they had two people that they were about to try for this murder, but they already had the evidence that this palm print, this bloody palm print from the crime scene, belonged to neither of them.
Right. You have this print that was captured the morning of the murder. So you have these fresh prints, and there were other prints captured from, I think, a lamp, Coke cans, other items within the home. And when they ran them against both Diamantina and Andres, there was no match.
That's insane. So you got to the point where, you know, you knew of the existence of this palm print, and you were basically ready to sort of run this print through the federal database. By now, there was a federal database called AFIS, which it connects all the different states and counties around the country. But then, before you were able to do this, and again, kind of important to explain, that we were on weekly Zoom calls at this point discussing what's happening, how the case is stalling because of whether it be lockdown or difficulties in obtaining paperwork, et cetera, different theories. This was an ongoing thing that I was sort of helping out in any way I could. But then something happened to proclaim justice. Do you want to tell us?
There were a lot of courts that were so backlogged. We had so much resistance from almost every legal entity that we were working with. And I think it was, you've got family members, you've got friends, you've got victims even that want to know what's going on, want to be updated. Meanwhile, as a nonprofit, you're trying to raise money to fund your plane tickets, your rental cars, your hotels, your document copying fees, your database reports that you're purchasing. And I think the drain financially, mentally, physically for leadership, it created some burnout, and John and Jason decided to move on to other things in life. I think it took its toll on both of them.
Proclaim Justice closed down, and I know John has stepped away from wrongful conviction work. So incredibly sad. And then I think it was you that told me the Innocence Project of Texas had decided to take on the case.
I made myself available to them and said, look, this case means a lot to a lot of people, and I am at your service to continue on for as long as we need. Anything that I can do to assist you, please don't drop the torch, you know, carry this on for us, for Andres.
So Proclaim Justice folded in September, and then the next month you were sitting in the Conviction Integrity Unit in Harris County to talk about what you'd found. So what did they say?
In that initial meeting, they had an officer within the Harris County Sheriff's Department that felt they could submit these prints to and have her run through APHIS. But then things flatlined and we didn't hear anything. And then there was a new chief, and her team went down to the evidence locker and located the actual items, the fireplace tile, other items, captured DNA, all the materials that were there, and walked them over to the Forensic Institute, giving them full authorization to run this, saying, we're the DA's office. We want you to process this information as instructed. And here we are. It still hasn't been processed. So,
and here we are. Danny, is it fair to say that they could literally run these bloody palm prints through APHIS and have an answer within, what, a day? Less than a day.
Yeah. But with the technology today through APHIS, they could get the top 20 hits in the national database system within 20 to 60 seconds.
Wow.
It may take minutes. It may take a couple hours to come in and further identify and lock in to reduce that 20 best hits down to one or two.
Do you feel, even though so much time has passed, do you feel in any way positive or confident that we are eventually going to have an answer?
I do, because I mean, you never give up. We didn't put all this in to just say, okay, they're just not going to do anything. Let's just move on to other things. I believe Andres is innocent. And I believe that in the end, it's going to be too hard to keep him in jail anymore because he didn't do it. I don't believe he did. You know, this is a 7-year journey. So for 7 years of my life and your life, this case is still at the forefront of our minds in many different ways.
Well, I feel that the reason we wanted to do this episode was because we feel like you do that we sort of see the end in sight, maybe.
Yeah, we do. I believe delays can only last for so long. You know, it can only rain for so long, and eventually the sun's going to come back out. It'll come through.
Let's hope so. Thanks a lot, Dan.
You bet. Anytime.
So really, Alex, there's one thing that I'd like to start with, having listened to that, something that we didn't have in our podcast series, and that is the bloody palm print. I mean, that is extraordinary.
You know, re-listening to Danny's interview highlights why a podcast might end, but the real story continues for those involved. And he was so determined to prove Andres' innocence. And Danny, through his work, you know, obtained these color photos from the sheriff's department, which had a much clearer image of the bloody palm print that was found at the scene. Now, what was crazy was that it was revealed that the detectives originally knew that this print didn't match Andres, Diamantina, or Daryl.
This palm print could exonerate Andres. And the fact that Danny's had this for a little while, and it hasn't been tested yet, and he says that it could just take a couple of minutes to test it, and it just seems extraordinary. I know everyone's busy and the cases are backed up, but it's not going to take someone very long to test that against the national database.
Yeah, I mean, look, the fact is that in 1998, they knew that this print didn't belong to Andres, and yet here they are saying that he was the one that carried out the murder. What they couldn't do back in 1998 was run it through a federal database of prints because that didn't exist at the time. So what Danny's saying is they already had the evidence it wasn't Andres, but right now, fast forward to today, and they can run that print through a system which will show potentially who it really is. And they haven't done that. And when you have a system that is just dragging its heels, that is this slow to do something that seems so straightforward, yeah, it's nuts.
And Danny explain the sad situation with Proclaim Justice, but he's something of a bridge, isn't he?
Yeah, so Danny basically said he would stay on and help the Innocence Project of Texas with their work.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Alex, who are we going to hear from now?
We're going to hear from Chase Baumgartner, who's a staff attorney with the Innocence Project of Texas, and a guy called Mike Ware, who is the executive director. And before we start, you know, you're going to hear reference to a garage door opener. That's among a bunch of things that they found at the crime scene that is still exists in the evidence locker that the Innocence Project of Texas have managed to get access to and which they tested for DNA because there was blood on it.
Okay, great. Let's listen to Mike and Chase.
It's June 2023. Proclaim Justice has shut up shop. But before they did, they handed over cases that they were still in the middle of investigating. You guys had agreed to take them on. And one of them was the Colajaco case. What made you decide to take it on?
Well, there is definitely a very believable, and we believe provable, alternative narrative of innocence. The other thing that appeared attractive about this case at first, and it's been more difficult than I had anticipated. You know, we wanted what appeared to be an unidentified print in the middle of the crime scene that didn't belong to any of the purported actors. We wanted that uploaded into the database and to attempt to identify who it was that likely put that print there in the middle of the crime scene.
At the time of Andres's trial, this is 1998, so we're in the infancy of DNA testing. And so something like the garage door opener, you know, they testified, the expert at the time, that there just wasn't enough DNA on the garage door opener for them to do any actual testing on. They knew it was blood, but they couldn't determine whose it was at the time. But they were able to get three DNA profiles connected to individuals through the testing even back in 1998. So they had a mob towel from the bathroom, and they were able to find Colajaco's DNA on that mob towel. Then they had a white towel, and they were able to find Andres' DNA on that white towel. But that white towel was taken right out of Andres' car, so the fact that his own blood is on his towel inside his car just didn't mean anything. But then, even back in 1998, this doorknob swab that they know is bloody has unknown DNA on it. They know it's not Andres. They know it's not Daryl Colajaco. And so they had this unknown person even in 1998. And so when I reviewed the case, I picked up on that and said, well, if we had an unknown in 1998, let's retest that and see if we can't find a CODIS eligible profile to enter into the database.
So a year on from when you took the case on, we're now in the summer of 2024. I think you forwarded me something around this time, which really blew my mind, which was the sheer amount of evidence that the Harris County Sheriff's Office still had in relation to the Mascaro case. And it's worth mentioning, I don't know if you remember this in the original podcast, but in October 2018, while we were making it, I actually put in a request asking if there was any property in the property room of the sheriff's office connected with the Mascaro case, and I didn't get a reply. But you guys just managed to discover that, and I've just got a few things I was going to mention, but it seems incredible. Baseball bats, driver door handle, garage door opener, TV remote, towel, beer cans, glasses, telephone, Coke cans, fireplace poker, hiking boots, shoes, shorts, socks, countless blood swabs and fingernail scrapings. And mid-December 2025, Chase, you wrote to me telling me that you finally, after several years, had an update, and it was a pivotal one. This is the partial DNA report that you got back. And I don't think they had Daryl Colajaco's reference sample when they issued the report.
That's correct. But
what did we learn from that?
What we found is that there's two swabs from the closet door, a lower portion and an upper portion. They found human DNA on these swabs. One's a mixture, and the one is a single source, meaning it comes from just one person. Mixture comes from more than one person. But Andres Mascaro is excluded as a possible contributor to both of those. So whoever's DNA is on these blood stains from the door, it's not Andres Mascaro.
So now we have the original evidence that was collected at the crime scene, all of the items that I just listed, and they excluded Andres from all of those that had blood on them. And now we have something that has been contemporaneously tested, and they've come back and said, the blood that we have tested does not have Andres's DNA in it.
Correct, yeah. And so what we're assuming is because this is blood and we don't have Colajaco's reference sample, is I expect that some of this blood, or most of this blood, is going to be Daryl Colajaco's. But what's really interesting, right, is this upper portion of the closet door is a mixture of at least two people. And so, yes, one of those is probably Daryl's, but whose DNA is mixed with Daryl Colajaco's blood on this closet door? And we know it's not Andres Mascaro.
And then, Mike, bringing you back in, answer me this. What happens next? So let's say you know, the next step is for law enforcement, the prison to give access, Andres to agree. You take this palm print from Andres, it's run against the print that we have on the tile. And if it's not Andres's palm print in this bloody tile, what happens then?
You know, whether it's the CODIS DNA database or the APHIS print database that leads to a side-by-side comparison with an alternative suspect that matches, I mean, that's our hope. So what we have to do now is hopefully find who the palm print and who the DNA does belong to.
What if the DNA sample, the testing comes back and it shows that of the two samples that were found, one of them is Daryl Colahacko's and that the other belongs to Angel Resendiz, for example? What happens then?
I mean, I think you move for a writ based on that new evidence that he's actually innocent, because the DNA that they didn't have at trial proves that the railroad killer is the one actually responsible for this case.
Again, throwing a curveball here, what if the results show Daryl Colahacko and another person that we haven't yet discussed?
You have to see who is that person, how did their DNA get mixed in there, and, you know, you investigate them and hopefully they give a confession as convincing as Resendiz gave to this one. You just have to pull those threads of why somebody's DNA is mixed with the victim's blood on, you know, a closet door.
Interesting. So it's sort of incredible news, but also equally frustrating.
So yes, what we're waiting on right now are kind of answers. We feel like we already know questions we already know the answer to. So in that sense, it is frustrating. But we are moving, which is always productive and optimistic.
In 2 months' time, it'll be 3 years since you took on the case. Can you have a stab at how long do we have left before we actually can see a sort of resolution to this case?
I don't want to make a prediction on that. Hopefully soon. I don't know. I've seen figures say the average exoneration takes 10 years. I don't think it will be that long, but I don't want to make a prediction on that.
Thank you both so much for chatting, and best of luck. Keep us in the loop.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
I mean, Alex, the tone was slightly different from the interview with Danny, but it's still revealing the cold bureaucratic friction of the Texas legal system. It's pretty extraordinary. But there was a huge breakthrough, wasn't there, Al? The DNA.
Yeah, look, I mean, I ended up calling Chase again after we recorded this interview because I sort of couldn't quite believe what I was hearing. And I thought, if I'm going to kind of sum this up for listeners, I need to absolutely make sure that what I'm about to say is accurate. We know that at the time of the murder, the bloody palm print found at the crime scene was run against Andres, Diamantina, and the victim, Daryl Colahacko, and it wasn't a match for any of them. And since the Innocence Project of Texas got involved, they very recently got a partial DNA result back from blood that was found in the house. And this has come back from the lab, and we now know categorically that Andres has been excluded. So we can say that based on blood DNA and a bloody palm print from the crime scene, Andres didn't do it.
This is proof beyond doubt.
I'm not a scientist. I'm not a lawyer. I called up Chase to confirm that my summary is correct. He told me this. None of the physical evidence taken from the crime scene has been tied to Andres. And listen to this, Pete. He went on, absent this confession, there is nothing. In fact, it points away from Andres. The science doesn't lie. This is a direct quote. And this is usually very good for our clients. So now we need to find out whose DNA was in that blood and who the palm print belongs to. The reason we decided to do this podcast now is because it feels like, for me, that we're sort of in this holding pattern that I don't think is fair. We need to speed things up. And I think that by telling the world what's happening and what justice really looks like, hopefully there's concern enough and hopefully the right people hear this and the wheels of justice start moving a bit quicker and we get justice for Andres.
So potentially the end is in sight.
You know, talking to Mike, Chase and Danny right now, it feels that those quiet years when I felt like nothing was happening weren't for nothing. It was slow, it was painful, but maybe that's what it took to force the system to pay attention. And if you fast forward to today, yeah, Andres is still in prison. He spent over 9,000 nights locked up for something he says he didn't do. and I believe him. But, you know, there's been a shift. For the first time in 27 years, it feels like the science might finally catch up. And I think we're about to have some answers.
Well, let's hope so, Alex, which means that hopefully we'll be back soon with more updates.
Yeah, 100%.
Great stuff. Okay, well, thanks for listening. And Alex, I will speak to you soon.
Speak to you soon, Pete.
Run for the fences, Riley.
When their backs are turned.
Follow the railroad, Riley.
When their backs are turned.
Up over the mountains, Riley.
When their backs are turned.
You find the place you're promised.
When their backs are turned. Run, run, run with the railroad. When their backs are turned. Run, run, run with the railroad. When their backs are turned.
Run, run, run with the railroad.
Get out of their sight.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.